Thanks for tuning into Moss Radio. This is the conclusion to the introduction of The Body in Pain, The Making and Unmaking of the World by Elaine Scarry. Given the fact that actual weapons ordinarily hurt rather than heal persons, it would be surprising if the iconography of weapons ordinarily worked to assist those in pain. And of course it does not. When, for example, the language of agency enters political discourse, its use is often very far removed from the one just summarized. As the following unpleasant example suggests, it is said that Richard Nixon's favorite saying whenever he had triumphed over and therefore discomforted a journalist was, "That really flicks the scab off." George Wallace once spoke of wanting to give his political enemy a barbed wire enema, and when publicly called on to apologize for his statement, he appeared to believe its scatology rather than its cruelty was the problem. The language of agency is again recognizable in Lyndon Johnson's verbal habit during the Vietnam period of describing a military or political victory as nailing the skin to the wall, and in a startling confusion of the large with the small, Ronald Reagan complained of the Soviet reaction to the American decision to produce a neutron bomb by saying, "The Russians are squealing like they're sitting on a sharp nail." It would be possible to debate for a long time the significance or insignificance of this language, for though clearly not innocent, the precise extent to which it is harmful is unclear. But what is both self-evident and undebatable is this: whether these sentences express what they do not express is physical pain. In none of the four does the sign of the weapon work to bestow visibility on the aversiveness of physical suffering. And in none of the four does the speaker invoke the sign in order to direct sympathetic attention to the felt experience of the person pictured as acted upon by the object. It will eventually become apparent that the particular perceptual confusion sponsored by the language of agency is the conflation of pain with power. For now, it is enough to notice that the mere appearance of the sign of a weapon in a spoken sentence, a written paragraph, or a visual image, for example, the litany of weapons in the writings of Sade, their occasional presence in a fashion photograph or painting, does not mean that there has been any attempt to present pain, and on the contrary, often means that the nature of pain has just been pushed into deeper obscurity. The negative use of the language of agency, only fleetingly suggests here, will in the opening chapter be shown not as it occurs in isolated sentences, but as it enters into the structure of larger events where it achieves the full extremity of its sadistic potential. In torture, it is in part the obsessive display of agency that permits one person's body to be translated into another person's voice, that allows real human pain to be converted into a regime's fiction of power. The sign of the weapon will again be attended to in the second chapter. For the perceptual confusion sponsored by the sign increases the difficulty of accurately identifying the function of injuring in war, and thus increases also the difficulty of identifying the precise character of the action that could plausibly be used in its place. As the language of agency has a central place in torture and war, the two events in which the ordinary assumptions of culture are suspended, so conversely, the basic structure of culture are centrally devoted to stabilizing the sign. The discussion of civilization's ongoing modifications of agency in the second half of the book, part 2, chapters 3-5, is sometimes framed explicitly in terms of changes in verbal or visual iconography. For example, the sign of the cross, the signs of the flag of nations, at other times is framed in terms of the restructuring, not of the icon or image, but the actual object. For example, the modifications in the form of the weapon that allow it to become transformed into the into a tool or into an artifact. And at still other times is framed in terms of the human actions associated with such objects. For example, the elaborate mental labor of disassociating wounding from creating in the Hebrew scriptures. The idiom of this last sentence, tool, artifact, restructure, creating, calls attention to the fact that there is a third subject in this book that has so far not been introduced. The nature of human creation. We have seen that physical pain is difficult to express, and that this inexpressibility has political consequences. But we will also see that those political consequences, by making overt precisely what is at stake in inexpressibility, begin to expose by inversion the essential character of expressibility, whether verbal or material. Thus, as our first subject led to a second, so the second leads just as inevitably to the third, the nature of human creation. What is it to uncreate and what is it to create eventually become central preoccupations of this book, as the overarching two-part division, unmaking and making, suggests. The way in which the material in the first half necessitates attention to the problem of creation addressed in the second can be briefly indicated here by first identifying in skeletal outline the central argument about torture and war, and then identifying what within the argument carries with it the requirement that making itself become better understood. Based on the verbal accounts of people who were political prisoners during the 1970s, chapter one shows that torture has a structure that is as narrow and consistent as its geographical incidence and is wide, as its geographical incidence is widespread. That structure entails the simultaneous and inseparable occurrence of three events, which, if described sequentially, would occur in the following order. First, the infliction of physical pain. Second, the objectification of the eight central attributes of pain. And third, the translation of those attributes into the insignia of the regime. The work of the opening chapter is only to identify and make manifest the three-part structure, but an example of the objectification and appropriation of any one of pain's attributes also begin to make it clear why the book, at a much later point, turns of necessity to the subject of creating. Physical pain, to invoke what is at this moment its single most familiar attribute, is language-destroying. Torture inflicts bodily pain that is itself language-destroying, but torture also mimes, objectifies in the external environment. This language-destroying capacity in its interrogation, the purpose of which is not to elicit needed information, but visibly to deconstruct the prisoner's voice. The word deconstruct rather than destroy is used in the previous sentence because to say the interrogation visibly destroys the prisoner's voice only implies that the outcome of the event is the shattering of the person's voice. And if this alone were the goal, there would be no need for a verbal interrogation, since the inflicted pain alone accomplishes this outcome. The prolonged interrogation, however, also graphically objectifies the step-by-step backward movement along the path by which language comes into being, and which is here being reversed or uncreated or deconstructed. We will see that this same mime of uncreating reappears consistently throughout all of the random details of torture, not only in relation to verbal constructs, for example, sentences and names, but also in relation to material artifacts, for example, a chair, a cup, and mental objects. In other words, the objects of consciousness. Thus, it eventually becomes clear that this is not simply a repeated element within the large framing event, but it is the framing event itself. In other words, as the overall three-part structure of action emerges before our eyes, we gradually begin to recognize what it is we are looking at, and what we are looking at is the structure of unmaking. The import of this will be returned to summarizing chapter 2. War, too, has a structure. As might be expected when one moves from what is essentially a two-person event to one involving hundreds of thousands of persons, and again, when one moves from an event premised on one-directional injuring to one premised on two-directional and reciprocal injuring, the structure of war is more complex, and the identification of that structure requires complicated sets of arguments and sub-arguments. The chapter is, however, divided into five sections of the overarching argument, and the overarching argument is carried through these divisions. Section 1, war is injuring, and 2, war is a contest, sets two premises in place in order to ask the question, what differentiates injuring from any other activity on which a contest can be based in order to arrive at a winner and a loser? This is a critically important question, since if injuring has only the solitary function of allowing one side to out-injure the other, and thus of designating one of the disputants the winner, almost any other human activity could by now have been substituted in its place. Thus, injuring must have a second function. Section 3 shows that the single answer that has been given to this question explicitly by Clausewitz and implicitly by 20th century political and military theorists, namely that war carries the power of its own enforcement, cannot possibly be true. Clausewitz worried about the probable falseness of the explanation, though his counterparts in this century seem less aware of its falsity. Section 5, the longest and most important phase of the argument, provides a different answer, showing the way the compelling reality of the injured bodies is being used at the end of the war to lend the aura of material reality to the winning construct, as well as to the concept of winning itself. Until there is time for the world participants to provide more legitimate means of substitution. Section 5 compares the use of the human body in torture and in war in order to account for the moral distance that separates their respective procedures of analogical verification. The basis of the distinction is consent. In war, the persons whose bodies are used in the confirmation process have given their consent over this most radical use of the human body, while in torture, no such consent is exercised. The chapter ends by showing that nuclear war more closely approximates the model of torture than the model of conventional war, because it is a structural impossibility that the populations whose bodies are used in the confirmation process can have exercised any consent over this use of their bodies. As were true of the torture chapter, the central purpose of the chapter on war is to identify the nature of the monolithic event under discussion and not to expose the interior shape of unmaking. But again, as in the torture chapter, we will see that the central purpose cannot be accomplished without also undertaking the second task, because the structure of war and the structure of unmaking are not two subjects but one. If, as the intricacies of this conflation emerge before us, they have the defect of sometimes seeming astonishing, they will also at every moment have the virtue of confirming the obvious, for that torture and war are acts of destruction, and hence somehow the opposite of creation, and they entail the suspension of civilizations and are somehow the opposite of that civilization, and are things we have always known, and things one immediately apprehends even when viewing these two events from a great distance. The only thing that could not have been anticipated from a distance, but that is forced upon us as self-evident once we enter the interior of these two events, is that they are, in the most literal and concrete way possible, an appropriation, aping, and reversing of the action of creating itself. Once the structures of torture and war have been exposed and compared, it becomes clear that the human action of making entails two distinct phases, making up mental imaging and making real, endowing the mental object with the material or verbal form, and that the appropriation and deconstruction of making occurs sometimes the first and sometimes the second of these two sites. Part 2 clarifies the structure of creating that emerges only in the inverted outline in Part 1. Chapter 3 attends specifically to mental imaging, or what was a moment ago called the phase of making up. And chapters 4 and 5 together examine the action of creating verbal and material artifacts, or what was a moment ago called the phase of making real. Because the central arguments of these chapters themselves depend on the detailed and substantive observations about bodily pain and injury that occur in the earlier chapters, they will be summarized and introduced at the transition of part 1 to part 2 as we move on to the path that eventually carries us past Pegasus and telegraphs, past altars, light bulbs and coats, past blankets, product liability trials and songs, as well as medical vaccines and sacred texts. The vocabulary of creating, inventing, making, imagining is not in the 20th century a morally resonant one. Imagining, for example, is usually described as an ethically neutral and amoral phenomenon. The phrase material making is simply flat in its connotations and is even, because of its conflation with materialism, sometimes pronounced with a derisive inflection. But an unspoken question begins to arise in part one, which might be formulated in the following way. Given that the deconstruction of creation is present in the structure of one event which is widely recognized as close to being an absolute of immortality, torture, and given that the deconstruction of creation is again present in the structure of a second event regarded as morally problematic by everyone and as radically immoral by some, war, it is not peculiar that the very thing being deconstructed, creation, does not in its intact form have a moral claim on us that is as high as others is low. That the action of creating is not, for example, held to be bound up with justice in the way those other events are bound up with injustice, that is, the mental, verbal, or material process of making the world, is not held to be centrally entailed in the elimination of the pain as the unmaking of the world is held to be entailed in pain's infliction. The morality of creating cannot, of course, be inferred from the immorality of uncreating and will instead be shown on its own terms. That we ordinarily perceive it as empty of ethical content is, it will be argued, itself a signal to us of how faulty and fragmentary our understanding of creation is. Not only is this respect, but in many others. Not only in this respect, but in many others. It is not the valorization of making, but its accurate description that is crucial. For if it is in the fact laden with ethical consequence, then it may be that a firm understanding of what it is will in turn enable us to recognize more quickly what is happening, not only in large-scale emergencies like torture or war, but in other long-standing dilemmas such as the inequity of material distribution. In the long run, we will see that the story of physical pain becomes as well a story about the expansive nature of human sentience, the felt fact of aliveness that is often cheerily happy, just as the story of expressing physical pain eventually opens into the wider frame of invention. The elemental as if of the person in pain, it feels as if, it is as though, will lead out into the array of counterfactual revisions entailed in making. This book is about the way other persons become visible to us or cease to be visible to us. It is about the way we make ourselves the originally interior facts of sentience available to one another through verbal and material artifacts, as it is also about the way the derealization of artifacts may assist in taking away another person's visibility. The title of the book, The Body in Pain, designates as the book subject the most contracted of spaces, the small circle of living matter, and the subtitle designates as its subject the most expansive territory, the making and unmaking of the world. But the two go together, for what is quite literally at stake in the body in pain is the making and unmaking of the world. Thanks so much again for tuning in, and for those of you who are returning, thanks again for your patience. This is Moss Radio.